Dave McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened with limited hours on limited days, Tuesday to Thursday and Friday, from 11 to 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget your mask. You can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted, as always, that I can have as my guest today for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, among several other books, and also a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country and around the world as well. And we appreciate him making time in his busy schedule to be part of the morning show to offer his thoughts and analysis on a variety of issues and concerns and questions. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Professor Berg. You're always so gracious. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just ask you, we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but we're, of course, you and I and everybody involved in not just higher education, but education period are operating under kind of strange constraints during this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. What has that done for something like the Clawson Center, where, of course, a bedrock part of what you have done is to bring important and distinguished visitors to the campus and have them engage with our students and faculty? And of course, those kind of in-person visits are just, I should think at least largely, not possible at the moment. So how has the Clawson Center been sort of pivoting and, in a sense, reshaping itself for this time of COVID?
Well, we obviously aren't having the public lectures that we previously had in person, as you indicate. Faculty have a good deal of initiative and resourcefulness in terms of bringing in visitors via Zoom or Google Meet. And Cassie Lau in particular, a leader on our campus in different dimensions, including many committee assignments. I should note she's been particularly imaginative in terms of bringing in helpful visitors via Zoom. In some ways, it's a way to reestablish or at least redefine and further strengthen relationships. We have a growing relationship with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, Mike Moscow, the particularly successful previous president of the Chicago Fed, was our Johnson Distinguished Visitor now about a decade ago, and that really opened the door to continued collaboration. Cassie has spearheaded the Fed Challenge and related competitive presentations for our students, and our plan is to expand with her leadership the relationship with the Fed as things open up more. Mock trial, where we are national champions on a consistent basis, three out of the last 5 years, I believe. It's been a priority for us since Mike Fegley a very, again, a very effective leader, enormously energetic, initiated the program at Carthage about a decade and a half ago. Their competitions are particularly intense. I strongly support the program as real-world education for our students, more important than ever, in my biased opinion, in higher education today. And I was very pleased. We had a scrimmage with Colorado College on Sunday over the weekend, and it worked just fine. So despite our fears, people have been able to adjust to the remote opportunities as well as challenges to in-person teaching. Students do want to learn in person. From my point of view, I think in-person instruction is better. One doesn't want to do anything unsafe or reckless, I hasten to add. But my classes are in person, and with only a couple of students who have a need to be remote. And I believe the last gentleman will be out of quarantine this week. So I'm looking forward to continuing what a very active class is.
Very good.
I hope that's a thorough enough answer. Thank you for asking about our Clausen Center. We all work together at Carthage College, and I'm very proud of the fact that our center has endured, and we've remained on a steady course, and we've been able to raise a good deal of money, including, but going well beyond, Mr. and Mrs. Clausen's gifts. And I hope that continues in the future, whatever unfolds in these unpredictable times in higher education.
Right. Very good. Before we do anything else, I think I want to give you an opportunity to reflect on the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, of course, passed away recently. And her presence was significant on the Supreme Court, but her whole career has been one of significance, it seems to me. And, of course, as her body lay in state, that was also a kind of a series of historic firsts. What are your thoughts about Ruth Bader Ginsburg in terms of her legacy and what might be ahead for the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, she was a natural leader, an outstanding, starting with her student days, an outstanding student. I think she went to Harvard Law School, but then transferred to Columbia. And tied with another student for the first place position. Thanks to your heads up, I was able to do a lot of research. She was certainly a brilliant person in intellectual terms and generally outspoken and willing to defend her positions on the court and beyond. She personified a trend that I think started with William O. Douglas way back in the 40s and 50s for Supreme Court justices to become more public figures and speak out on public matters. It reflects wider social changes in our society over time. And she, again, was quite willing to be a public figure.
In the wake of her death, there's, of course, every likelihood that the Supreme Court is going to turn still more conservative in its tilt should President Trump's nominee Amy Coney Barrett be indeed if her nomination is ratified by the U.S. Senate. What do you think that potentially means for the country?
I think we tend to focus very heavily on the partisan divisions today and let them invade too many aspects of life, from my point of view. It's extremely important to look beyond the headlines and keep in mind certain facts. The vast majority of Supreme Court decisions are not 5-4. They're 9-0, believe it or not, 8-1. There are a lot of 6-3 decisions. The second point is when people come onto the court, and I think this is the way the Founding Fathers intended, that relatively removed institution among the three branches to function, they tend to be a little unpredictable. And we'll see what unfolds. Clearly, things are a lot more partisan now. I believe Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed by something like 96-3 in the Senate. And with the growth of intense partisanship in the Congress and the fact that we no longer legislate controversial matters the way we used to. The Supreme Court clearly is more politicized today. And therefore, you know, votes in the Senate tend to be along partisan lines pretty predictably. But the Republicans have a narrow majority and there don't seem to be any electorate. So I will courageously predict that she probably will be confirmed.
We are recording this interview Tuesday morning, and tonight will be the first of, I believe, three presidential debates between President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. In a recent column, you reminded all of us about the significance of the very first televised presidential debate back in 1960 between then incumbent Vice President Richard Nixon and the Democratic candidate for president, John F. Kennedy. And I appreciated the fact that even though a lot of us probably feel like we know a fair amount about that historic first televised presidential debate, that in fact there are all kinds of fascinating facts that are really illuminating and have significance to this very day. First of all, what do you think is most important for us to understand about those 1960 debates, and in what way did they lay the groundwork for all the debates that have come since?
Well, it shows the importance of the modern media, doesn't it? And one can debate, and we can discuss, if you wish, who won the debate. I regularly show the first of the four debates. They're readily available on YouTube. It's about everything else nowadays. And I really urge our listeners to take a look and listen to at least the first debate, and ideally all four. It showed the importance of television. It showed the priority the Kennedy Organization gave to the media. The president's father, Joseph Kennedy, made a great deal of money in various enterprises, but early on in Hollywood, where he went his own way, as usual in the business world, he really appreciated the importance of the media. John Kennedy, a very gifted politician and campaigner, one of the few Republican victories, one of the few Democratic victories in Republican sweep in 1952, was Kennedy's surprise win over Henry Cabot Lodge, a well-established, enormously influential Eastern establishment figure from an enormously influential family who was generally considered to be unbeatable. There was a radio debate between Senators Lodge and Kennedy, which I think shows early on the extreme awareness of the importance of the media. I read that Senator John Kennedy was also one of the first to use a teleprompter, and he would have not one but two teleprompters on the scene, along with tremendous additional logistical and organizational support, and savvy people observed at the time, that's Joe Kennedy in action. Don't leave anything to chance. In terms of the substance of the debate, Nixon looks a bit irritable and resentful, as he often did, apparently, with very... It's not apparent. It is apparent and undoubtedly, and it's factual, that he was quite exhausted and rather poor health. Thanks to a staff infection when they appeared. But another reason why Nixon looked resentful was the fact that he often did, was they were supposed to be talking about domestic politics. And Jack Kennedy quite shamelessly drove the debate into foreign policy, kept returning to the fact that the allegation believed to be the truth at the time, that the Soviet Union was indeed burying us well ahead of us, not only militarily, especially in intercontinental ballistic missiles, which is false, but also economically and engineering and education across the board. And his emphasis on this being relentlessly clearly got under Nixon's skin, who tried politely to return things to domestic affairs. None of the foreign newsmen called Kennedy on this, which shows that political partisanship in the media is certainly not good. Endlessly fascinating. I think the most important point, Nixon had been going around the country describing himself as a senior statesman on the right hand of Eisenhower, so much so that I at one point clearly expressed some irritation. publicly about this, and unfortunately, Nixon. And Kennedy was this kind of teenager, inexperienced, by agreeing to appear equally on the television stage, especially. Kennedy was able simply by that to establish equal standing with Nixon and undercut whatever advantage Nixon might have had. They were about the same age, and they had very similar careers in many ways. Very different backgrounds, of course.
I thought one of the most interesting observations in your column, and I've heard it this essentially said before, but I liked the way you said it. I mean, I think we all know that when it comes to the, there's no question but that Kennedy was the victor. I mean, with the visuals that we've already been talking about. But you write in your column, but a review of the transcripts of the encounter shows Nixon was more orderly and logical, more organized and specific. So in other words, when it comes to the substance of what was said, there are many ways in which Nixon was maybe the more impressive of the two. And I think that's borne out by the fact that I think when people were polled who only listened to the debate over the radio versus watching it on television, a majority of people felt that Nixon was the victor rather than Kennedy.
That's a widely quoted story. Be careful about that one. I think Theodore White, the famous Time journalist, initially brought that up. I may be wrong about that, but it's based on very, very limited polling evidence at best. I think it probably is true. More important is that by 1960, there was at least one television set for every American home. Post-war prosperity was really very much in evidence, even as early as 60, growing tremendously through the 50s. The vast majority of people didn't have a TV at the beginning of the 50s. So those who were listening to the debates on radio, I think it's reasonable to infer that they were mostly older, mostly rural, probably most of the Republican or traditional. So there are a lot of factors at play, but what people should do is not only watch the debates on YouTube, but get a hold of the transcripts and make up your own mind, as I tell the students. But I think being as objective as I can, Nixon is clearly more orderly. Students think they're both very good. I showed my class, one of my classes, the chunk of the first debate, and as usual, it's current students. They think they're both dignified men. They're very impressive. They're so polite to each other. One young lady said it's a real contrast with today's public culture. And once in a while, Jack Kennedy will sweep a group of young people off their feet, figuratively. And that happens occasionally. But today's students generally are very much impressed by both men. And they are both very impressive, gifted politicians. But Kennedy had the edge. Believe it or not, a lot of Americans did not know who Jack Kennedy was in 1960. Hard to believe today, but that was the fact.
As I mentioned, we're recording this interview Tuesday morning, and tonight will be the first debate between President Trump and challenger Joe Biden. Do you care to make any predictions about what you think is likely to unfold tonight or over the course of these several debates? I mean, it seems like it is a very different matchup than, for instance, Kennedy versus Nixon.
No, I'm not going to be foolish enough to make a prediction. I'm a professor, and we are very good at predicting the past. very careful about the future, especially given my track record, political and otherwise. However, I do think debates generally don't have a big impact on public opinion. Four Kennedy-Nixon debates were on balance helpful to Kennedy, but it was very much a seesaw election contest where they were generally pretty close. The one debate that made a difference, and again, an older candidate was involved, was 1980, which isn't mentioned much. Incumbent President Jimmy Carter confronted former governor of California, Ronald Reagan. And that's the one in presidential campaign encounter where Reagan, who was 8 points behind Carter in polls consistently, shot up and Carter plummeted and Reagan won by, I believe, 10% of the popular vote. Quite extraordinary and remarkable. And that's the one occasion, and again, it was an older candidate who was much criticized for being too old. He was around 70 then, and he was the oldest. He was about the same age as William Henry Harrison, who only served a couple months in the 1840s. But he was the oldest post-war president at that point. And Reagan, who actually made a lot of gaffes, made factual mistakes, he projected an air of confidence and authority that effectively overwhelmed Carter, who was also beleaguered by stagflation, the lethal, economically lethal combination of unemployment and high inflation that plagued the country through the 70s, the Iran hostage crisis. He had been severely wounded by Ted Kennedy, who challenged him for the nomination. And I think he was politically bleeding from that point. So all these things kind of came together in that one dramatic debate. Finally, I realize I'm answering at length, but these are, you ask, you know, important questions. Don Anderson, a very independent Republican congressman, challenged, ran as a third-party nominee. Carter refused to acknowledge him. Reagan quite shrewdly debated him separately. And I think Reagan got a lot of credit for being fair play, for being a gentleman, doing generous thing in terms of meeting Anderson. And that also was in play by the time Carter and Reagan came together. Carter's aloofness reinforced an image of maybe waspishness or nastiness that earlier unfairly plagued Carter.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, and we are talking about a number of different issues and questions, and we're going to turn our attention to Great Britain for the moment, and the headline that I saw for this particular column was something about the agony of Britain's Brexit, and this is a column in which Professor Sear explores some recent moves made by Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he seeks to help Britain kind of navigate its way through this process known as Brexit. The vote of the British public, I think back in 2016, is what set these wheels in motion. And if I understand correctly, Britain effectively left the European Union in January of this year, but now we are in the midst of kind of what is sort of a transition year in which the cords are further cut. But apparently Prime Minister Boris Johnson is moving forward with some legislation in the British Parliament that very directly disregards some of what was in place in some sort of agreement with the EU. Professor Sear, tell us more about this legislation and what you find concerning about it.
Well, the problem is Northern Ireland, the Protestant enclave at the northern tip of the island of Ireland, historically a source of great conflict from about 1970 until the end of the 20th century, renewed Irish Republican violence in Britain and Unionist violence against the Irish in Ulster and Ireland, and IRA violence in Northern Ireland, that bloody, very mean-spirited religious conflict, sectarian conflict, reemerged. Ireland is part of the European Union, and Britain's leaving the European Union provides a challenge for Northern Ireland. The agreement that the British government and the European Union officials in Brussels reached that special provision so that goods, services, people from Northern Ireland could move through the island of Ireland and also through Britain with minimal restrictions. Prime Minister Johnson has suddenly and quite arbitrarily brought up legislation that declares explicitly that Britain will not consult with European Union officials in terms of moving goods, services, and people, especially goods from Ulster to Northern Ireland through the rest of the British Islands. And in other ways, will simply ignore the rules of the European Union. This is breaking a treaty that they signed. It's caused a tremendous public as well as political reaction in Britain, as well as outrage in Brussels. A lot of smart people think that it's all a ploy, the negotiations for the details of Britain actually terminating involvement in the EU without tremendous disruption to business, to banking, to services, professional qualifications, and simple movement of people and goods. Those negotiations have been going badly, so some people think this is a ploy on Johnson's part to get some advantage vis-a-vis Brussels. We'll see how it plays out. The Conservatives have a tremendous majority in the House of Commons thanks to their victory last December, but it's conceivable that the Prime Minister loses, like the President of the United States, given the extreme and unpredictable rhetoric and occasionally actions, and this is one of them. It could reignite the violence in Northern Ireland, which we want to avoid at all costs. Mm-hmm. American leaders have played a significant role in that peace agreement at the end of the century, and I hope responsible Americans will stay involved. Mm-hmm.
One thing that leapt out at me as I read your column about this was the denunciation of Boris Johnson and this move by several of his predecessors. I mean, you had quite a list of names, and at a glance off the top of my head, I didn't remember if all of them were former prime ministers, but certainly
yes,
at least three of them were, three or four of them were. And it at least in this country, it's not all that often when you'll have, you know, maybe four or five living ex-presidents all voice, you know, unanimous opposition to something or support of something. And that just, that seemed fairly significant that the outcry would include voices like that.
Yes, indeed. Well, the rule of law is important. It's not just a slogan. And our British friends have really spearheaded what to us is the right way of going about life domestically and internationally. Common law system we get directly from them. That's the bedrock of our own government, as we all know. Internationally, reflecting the fact that Britain was the great and dominant trading nation from just after medieval times into the 20th century is reflected in the fact that they spearheaded international law in commercial terms. They kind of succeeded the Roman Catholic Church in terms of trying to create international rules that would limit warfare. British spearheaded the creation of the anti-slavery movement and the anti-slavery societies in their country and elsewhere. And the British Navy enforced a ban on the slave trade, I think 1808, that was extremely important and painful and difficult but vital for human morality and progress we've made on that front. So It's a deeply felt fundamental core of our modern civilized life, and the Prime Minister is overthrowing that by saying it doesn't matter if it's a treaty, we're going to break it. And the dissent, looking beyond all I have to say on the subject of whatever help, take a look at the Conservative Party and pay close attention to this dissent against the Prime Minister. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, the last two Labour Prime Ministers, are strongly against this, but also John Major, a very respected figure in Britain, Margaret Thatcher's Conservative successor, and Theresa May, the former Prime Minister just before John. His own party is very much against him on this matter.
Hmm. Interesting.
I hope it is just a well-calculated ploy, and not the prime minister being his nutty self.
Right. By the way, to what extent has the EU been hurt or felt the impact of Britain's withdrawal from the EU? Do we know very much about that?
Yes. Well, the public health problem, the coronavirus, because that has been so disruptive, it's a little hard to tease out what's specifically related to the Britain's withdrawal from the EU. I think it has been disruptive in terms of individual people who are uncertain whether they're healthcare workers, their medical credentials, or legal credentials, accounting, other professional credentials will continue to be respected on both sides of the English Channel. It has the potential to greatly disrupt trade and investment of all kinds. But as you indicated, this is a transition year. January, and they haven't until December to work things out. So by December, if there's no agreement, we may see some really significant disruption.
Let's talk about another prime minister that you wrote about recently, namely the prime minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe,
yes,
who is about to step down, I believe because of health difficulties. Do I remember that correctly?
It's a real health problem. It's not a diplomatic health problem.
In fact, you mentioned that earlier in his career, in an earlier stint as prime minister, ill health forced him to, in a sense, step down prematurely. But what you spend most of your time writing about is the remarkable legacy of Japan's longest-serving prime minister. Tell us more about the period of time in which he has overseen Japan's government and the kind of challenges that he has met, evidently quite impressively, in your opinion.
Yes, indeed. Well, he is the longest serving prime minister in Japan, and that's notable in and of itself. A prominent journalist not too many years ago referred to the new guy in Japan, a sort of offhand reference to the fact that prime minister would last for a couple of years, more or less, and then be replaced. His durability of tenure, I think, is extremely good for them and for us, and given Japan's extraordinarily important economic and growing political role in the world, I think it's good for everyone that they've been able to sort of break through the logjam of relatively ineffective leadership. There have been some minor corruption problems and accusations concerning its regime, which have been prominent in the media, but as far as I know, there's certainly nothing that's touched the prime minister directly. Japan still has the second largest economy in the world, important to keep in mind given our obsession with China. Currently, the second largest economy in the world in terms of per capita gross product. It's an enormously powerful and productive economy in ways that China is not, or at least not yet. For the last 5 years, starting with a run-up to the 2016 election, protectionism and sort of lack of interest in spearheading trade agreements, especially multilateral trade agreements, has characterized the United States. We focus rightly on President Trump, but Hillary Clinton dramatically moved away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the most recent multilateral trade effort where the U.S. played a leading role, the TPP. She changed her position on that even before she got the Democratic nomination. From my point of view, that creates a vacuum, and Japan has effectively moved to fill it. The Free and Open Indo-Pacific Partnership, FOIP, something that's not much in the news, but involves very significant economic cooperation involving India, Australia, the U.S., Japan, and other countries in the Pacific region. In the U.N., where Japan, since World War II, has been a major leader, that role has expanded. Japanese warships. They don't have an enormous navy, but it's growing all the time, and it's technologically extremely advanced. There's close collaboration between the Japanese and U.S. militaries across the board, but especially in navy terms, not surprisingly. They're a maritime nation. Japanese warships are now patrolling on missions related to the UN and NATO involvement in Afghanistan on a regular basis in the Indian Ocean. It's the first time they've appeared there since 1945. In lots of different ways, Japan's leadership is growing steadily. It's very positive. And one of the most interesting, endlessly interesting papers by our fine students, Logan Prank, a very strong student in every way, graduate in international political economy, the major I currently oversee. He did a very fine paper on Japan's, the history of Japan's international involvement, and described in great detail how in the 1800s, after Japan was opened up forcefully by the U.S. Navy on a diplomatic mission sent by President Millard Fillmore and led by Commodore Perry. Japan really started to focus on Britain as a country they'd like to emulate in the Pacific. And in lots of different ways, those cultural ties remain strong. Not long thereafter, German nationalist economists especially became extremely influential in Japan. And as militarism grew in both countries in the 20th century, they developed an intense emotional reaction for one another. Since the war, Friedrich List, the German, very nationalistic economist and protectionist, was very influential in Japan. Since World War II, I think there's been an opportunity which the Americans have nurtured for Japan to return to that earlier tradition, including strong parliamentary government. And we should all feel good about the fact that that's been achieved. I really want to thank Logan Frank for aiding my education on the subject. I've stayed at Carthage as long as I have because of the great blessing of being around young people as one gets a little bit older in life.
I know the feeling. I was.
So look beyond China to make a brief statement for a change. Look beyond our current obsession with China to really understand Japan and the Pacific more generally.
I was surprised to read in your column that Japan is number two in the world in gross domestic product per capita.
Thank you for reiterating that point that I made at the beginning of my rather lengthy comments.
So they're a significant player, and you're right. We tend not to think about them as much as we tend to obsess with China and Russia and so on. But
Yes, indeed.
let's turn our attention
Greg.
for a few minutes to Afghanistan. And you wrote a column about, first of all, peace negotiations that are underway there. And apparently, a very significant meeting occurred back on the 12th of September between representatives of the Afghanistan government and representatives of the Taliban movement. This is something that, in a sense, perhaps bodes well for the future of Afghanistan. And of course, it comes at a time when the United States is in the process of withdrawing from Afghanistan and from this long and painful conflict. Tell us, first of all, about these peace negotiations and their potential significance.
Well, rather reminiscent of the revolutionaries in Vietnam who refused to talk to the South, refused to acknowledge the existence of the government of South Vietnam throughout our long war there, and in fact, as a condition for any kind of armistice with the U.S. and South Vietnamese forces, kept insisting that the U.S. government overthrow the government of South Vietnam. And just about every other way, those two armed conflicts are very different. But it rings a bell with me because you see the intense and unyielding fanaticism that often characterizes durable revolutionary movements. Well, things have changed. As you quite rightly point out, in Doha, interestingly enough, the capital of Qatar, earlier this month, representatives of the Taliban and the Afghanistan government got together and are negotiating. The close presidential election last year in Afghanistan led to not quite so serious, but very serious trouble. Incumbent President Ashraf Ghani was finally declared the winner, but challenger Abdullah refused to accept this, and it's characteristic of the undemocratic nature of Afghanistan, past and present. But they too have worked things out. In the world nowadays, there's a lot of working things out, it seems to me. They are sharing power in Kabul. We've been in Afghanistan for almost 2 decades. My own strong personal opinion is we really should be leaving, and I'm very glad that President Trump made that a goal from the campaign in 2016, and that in March, I think this year, we announced we would be withdrawing. Yeah. I don't think we're going to withdraw. The Pentagon has a way of staying involved no matter what. Presidents come and go, but the military-industrial complex is permanent, and I hope that doesn't sound too cynical. It's not unpatriotic. It's just a statement of fact. So some of our representatives, including those carrying weapons, are going to stay in Afghanistan. Basically, we're going to be out.
I'd love to have you expand on another point in this column, which talks about the relationship between the United States and Afghanistan, even apart from or beyond just the fact that we have had troops there for such a long time. But the fact that at some point, I don't remember when, we actually became formal allies for all the differences that there are between our two countries. But also you go on to explain kind of an interesting designation that Afghanistan has, as I think you called it, a strategic partner. I mean, it's not just, you know, you're not just, that's not your own verbiage, but apparently that's at least somewhat official designation that certain countries have. Tell us more about that.
In July 2012, the two nations became formal allies. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was the point person in developing that new and more formal alliance. As a result, Afghanistan joined 14 other nations in the distinctive special category of strategic partner of the U.S. These include Argentina, Australia, Israel, and Japan. Other partners are a good deal more well-established politically and much stronger economically than Afghanistan. It's interesting that we made that formal commitment.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to ask you about something that has sparked quite a lot of conversation, and it is around the whole notion of peaceful transfer of power and the fact that that President Trump was asked, this is sometime within the last week, maybe about a week ago now, when asked, you know, about whether or not he was committing at this point to a peaceful transfer of power, if by chance he should lose the election in November, his answer was quite wavering. Well, we'll have to see what occurs and so on, but did not come right out and affirm the notion of a peaceful transfer of power. And of course that sparked widespread concern, including some from his own party, and it kind of brought to mind something that perhaps Americans tend to take for granted, namely the fact that this is a long legacy about which we should really be proud, and also of which we should be protective. What are your thoughts on this whole notion of peaceful transfer of power? And and even if President Trump to some extent might have a wavering commitment to it, are there safeguards in place which ensure that will nevertheless occur should he lose the election?
Well, perhaps we've kind of first full circle, Professor Berg. We started talking about the rule of law, and one prediction I will make is I believe the rule of law will continue. I believe President Trump is a maestro. He's a genius at staying in the center of the media and saying things. I think one of the characteristics of the president is he says a lot more than he actually does, and we can all thank God for that, from my biased point of view. But he's very good at setting off a media firestorm, especially in the hostile mainstream media. And people get upset, and he's stage center, and his base is reinforced, and then we move on to the next shocking statement and horrible speculation that leads us all to fear that we might faint. An actual fact that I might mention beyond my endless opinions, with President Obama's completion of his second term, our first African-American president, we have had three administrations in succession where presidents completed two terms: the Clinton administration, the George W. Bush administration, and of course the Obama administration. The last time we had three two-term presidents in a row was early in the 19th century: Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. So that's a fact that might help you from becoming too alarmed about the horrifying prospect that Trump may refuse to leave the White House if he loses, or maybe ever. Who knows, if he gets reelected, what he might say at the end of a second term if he survives. But in point of fact, institutionally and legally, we are quite stable. So thank you. Very subtly, you've returned us to where we began, sir, the rule of law.
Right. Well,
it is really quite extraordinary.
Well, and it seems to me that for whatever reason, President Trump said what he said, whether he has misgivings about that whole notion of peaceful transfer or was consciously trying to fan some flames or whatever, the fact remains that it had the effect, it seems to me, of having all of us think about something that we probably don't think enough about and don't significantly appreciate.
Well, I rest my case. Thank you.
Dr. Art Sear. We
mustn't become complacent about our Constitution. Thank you. Yeah. Why we've got the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, among several other books, and a columnist whose work appears extensively in newspapers across the country, including right across town, the Kenosha News, and many other places as well. Professor Sear, I always appreciate the fact that in your very busy schedule, you make time for the morning show. It's always great to talk with you, and I thank you for today's conversation.
Well, you're always so kind and generous. I thank you, and Tom Clausen thanks you, too.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, best-selling author Deborah Tannen. I've had the pleasure of speaking with her a couple of times on The Morning Show. This time around, it's about her latest book, a beautiful memoir called Finding My Father, a book about her extraordinary father and their relationship. Friday's Morning Show will include a conversation with Ted Williams, no, not the baseball legend, but rather a one of America's most highly acclaimed nature writers, and his latest book written to honor the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, called Earth Almanac, A Year of Witnessing the Wild from the Call of the Loon to the Journey of the Great Whale. And on Monday, a wonderful novel based on the life of Lucille Ball, The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story by Darren Strauss. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened with limited hours on limited days. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, 11 to 5. Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget your mask. And by the way, you can still shop online at Jack and Dre.